the CBS News Weekend Roundup in 60 seconds.
In 2001, Vonage revolutionized home phone service, making it better. After such a colossal breakthrough, who would have objected if Vonage said, "Enjoy better, world. Vonage will be at the spa." But today, Vonage is not at the spa having its trouble area worked on, but transforming communications for your business with award-winning cloud-based solutions. See how your business can get the better it deserves. Call 1-800-5-VONAGE or go to Vonage.com. Vonage, the business of better.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, a wrap-up of the week with background and analysis from the correspondents who cover the news. And now from Washington, here's CBS News national correspondent Dan Revie.
Again, a mass murder dominates the headlines in the United States. President Obama mourns the victims, but also says we've become numb. He calls for more gun control laws. As we'll hear, there's no indication Congress will pass anything new. You'll hear reports from the crime scene, a community college in southwestern Oregon. Later, Russia's Air Force has begun bombing in Syria, and the United States government is annoyed. We'll have a report on Presidents Obama and Putin, who were together in New York. And congressional Republicans grilled the head of Planned Parenthood for 5 hours, hoping to cut off federal funding. You'll hear a report by CBS's Nancy Cordes.
Why do you need federal dollars? You're making a ton of dough.
Republicans pummeled Planned Parenthood's president, Cecile Richards, over her $500,000 salary and the $5 million the group spent on travel in 2013.
$14,000 a day, is it?
I don't have the figures.
Also, job growth in the U.S. has slowed. Those stories and a lot more on the Weekend Roundup. But first, the murder of 9 people Thursday morning by one young man who invaded a community college in Roseburg, Oregon. He was killed in a shootout with police. Authorities revealed part of what he said to his victims. This, according to survivors, he demanded they say what their religion was. Then he seemed to pick on those who declared they were Christians.
They would stand up and he said, "Good, because you're a Christian, you're going to see God in just about 1 second." And then he shot and killed them.
Here's what CBS News correspondent John Blackstone reported Friday morning from the campus of Umpqua Community College.
The first sign of trouble on the Umpqua campus was around 10:40 Thursday morning.
We have upwards of 20 victims.
This student says her teacher heard loud noises in the classroom next door.
She said, "Hey, is everyone okay over there?" And then as soon as she said that, multiple shots were fired. The look on her face was horrifying, and that's when I knew something was wrong.
I didn't hear any gunshots. I heard screaming.
Law enforcement arrived on the scene 5 minutes after the first 911 call. 7 minutes after police got to the campus, the gunman was dead.
The suspect is down. We've got multiple gunshot wounds. We're going to need multiple ambulances.
Hundreds of people attended a candlelight vigil in Roseburg late Thursday.
They will live forever in our hearts.
I don't know who all passed away, so I don't know if one of my family members or friends is in there.
The sheriff of Douglas County, Oregon, declared he won't say the name of the killer, not wanting to give him any publicity. He was a young man born in Britain, brought to the U.S. when he was a little boy. CBS's Jeff Pagaz has more.
Investigators say 26-year-old Chris Harper Mercer committed the crime using 3 handguns and an assault rifle. His MySpace profile shows him holding a rifle. Ian Harper is Mercer's father.
I am just as shocked as everybody at what happened. Obviously, it's been a devastating day. Devastating for me and my family.
Mercer left a social media footprint on a Torrance website where a blog attributed to him had recent posts. In August, he weighed in on the shooting of 2 television journalists in Roanoke, Virginia, saying of that gunman, "A man who was known by no one is now known by everyone. Seems the more people you kill, the more you're in the limelight."
The federal ATF says 6 guns were recovered at the school and 7 more at the shooter's home. CBS's Steve Futterman reported from Roseburg, usually a quiet logging town.
The city of Roseburg is reacting really much the same as other cities that have suffered these mass shootings. I have covered a number of them, and often the reaction is the same. People say they know these things happen, but they say they never thought it would happen in their town.
At the White House, President Obama seemed angry, speaking for over 10 minutes about the mass killing at the college in Oregon. Just a small part of what he said.
Somehow this has become routine. The reporting is routine. My response here at this podium ends up being routine. We've become numb to this.
The president called on Congress to pass some common sense gun regulations.
This is a political choice that we make to allow this to happen every few months in America. We collectively are answerable to those families who lose their loved ones because of our inaction.
Let's turn to CBS News correspondent Stephen Portnoy at the Capitol. Will Congress be moved by this crime to pass anything?
It seems as though sympathy and best wishes will be expressed by members of Congress, but it's been 2.5 years since the last Senate attempt to ramp up background checks. It was an effort when Democrats controlled the chamber that fell 6 votes short of breaking a filibuster. You have Republicans now who, as they're electing their new crop of leaders, aim to show how conservative they can be, and gun control does not likely wind up on top of their agenda.
Congress did accomplish something, averting a possible government shutdown by approving spending till December 11th. And Speaker John Boehner is resigning, likely to be replaced by Kevin McCarthy, a Republican from California, the House Majority Leader. He got in some controversy over the way he described the accomplishments of the Benghazi Investigation Committee.
In a TV interview this past week, McCarthy suggested that the Benghazi Committee has succeeded in reducing Hillary Clinton's political standing. That since the formation of the Benghazi Committee and the dive into her private emails, she has taken a dip in the polls, and that that has been something positive that's come out of the Benghazi panel. Well, Democrats seized on that. Republicans, many of them said it was an inappropriate remark to suggest that the Benghazi Committee is about something or anything other than getting to the truth of the deadly 2012 attack.
Not about attacking Hillary Clinton. At the Capitol, that's CBS's Stephen Portnoy. Thank you, Stephen.
You bet.
In Syria, the civil war became more complicated as Russia's Air Force started bombing rebel towns. CBS's David Martin had that news at the Pentagon on Wednesday.
Targets, which Russia said were weapons, ammunition, and other military equipment belonging to terrorists, were in areas controlled by groups fighting to overthrow the regime of Bashar al-Assad. In other words, Russia is not joining the U.S. in the fight against ISIS, but instead intervening on the side of Assad.
The U.S. and Russian militaries have begun deconfliction, exchanging information so that pilots won't accidentally crash into each other or shoot each other. On Monday at the United Nations in New York, President Obama met with Russian President Vladimir Putin. It did not appear friendly, as CBS's Margaret Brennan reported.
A stiff handshake kicked off their first meeting in more than 2 years after both Presidents Obama and Putin publicly blamed the other for the brutal war in Syria and outlined two different plans to stop it. Putin said it would be an enormous mistake not to join forces with the Syrian regime led by Bashar al-Assad, while President Obama blamed Assad's own brutality for feeding the rise of extremists like ISIS.
Tyrants like Bashar al-Assad, who drops barrel bombs to massacre innocent children. We must recognize that there cannot be, after so much bloodshed, so much carnage, a return to the pre-war status quo.
That was at the UN on Monday. Up next, House Republicans were tough on Planned Parenthood.
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's Dan Revie.
The issue that motivated a threat to shut down the federal government was an effort by Republican conservatives in Congress to ban any funding to Planned Parenthood. They felt there was evidence this year that body parts and tissue from unborn fetuses were sold by that health organization. CBS News correspondent Nancy Cordes reports.
Why do you need federal dollars? You're making a ton of dough.
Republicans pummeled Planned Parenthood's president, Cecile Richards, over her $500,000 salary and the $5 million the group spent on travel in 2013.
$14,000 a day, is it?
I don't have the figures.
Okay, well, that's what you provided.
I'm happy to look.
I just want to make sure.
Planned Parenthood gets roughly $500 million a year from the government for non-abortion-related health services. Richards argued 80% of it comes in the form of Medicaid payments for low-income patients.
We don't get a big check from the federal government. We actually are reimbursed for services delivered.
As she testified, supporters held dozens of rallies around the country, from Los Angeles.
It's not a privilege, it's a right.
To San Antonio.
Lives are at stake here.
To Portland, Maine.
One in five women will turn to Planned Parenthood at some point in their lifetime for health care services.
At a rally on Capitol Hill, Democrats accused Republicans of trying to roll back women's rights.
Let us recognize that we're standing up against tyranny unlike we've not seen in a long time.
One of the most persistent questioners at the hearing on Tuesday was Jason Chaffetz, Republican of Utah. He was in the news the next day when it was revealed that some people in the U.S. Secret Service were out to embarrass him using a document from Secret Service files, as CBS News correspondent Jeff Pegues reported on Wednesday.
Anybody. As head of the House Oversight Committee, Congressman Jason Chaffetz has investigated misconduct by the Secret Service, including an incident in March when agents allegedly drove drunk on White House grounds. A Department of Homeland Security Inspector General report says, in retaliation, some at the Secret Service sought to embarrass Chaffetz by accessing his 2003 application to be an agent. His file was protected by the Privacy Act, but according to the report, Assistant Director Ed Lowry wrote in an email, some information that he might find embarrassing needs to get out. Days later, it was leaked to the media. The report says at least 45 members of the Secret Service viewed the application. The Inspector General concluded the conduct was simply wrong.
I don't trust him. I really don't trust him.
Chaffetz says the disclosure reflects deeper problems at the agency.
If they're doing this to me, who knows what else they're doing? It really is scary.
The assistant director who sent the email says he was just venting and did not want the information leaked. The director of the Secret Service, Joe Clancy, apologized to Chaffetz and said that he will take appropriate disciplinary actions.
That from CBS's Jeff Pegues. Now to Georgia, where a woman who plotted the murder of her husband was executed despite a plea from Pope Francis to spare her life. CBS News correspondent Mark Strassman.
Calls to save Kelly Gissendaner's life echoed outside the state prison in Jackson, Georgia on Tuesday night. But after more than 5 hours of delays, the 47-year-old, who spent 18 years in prison for plotting the murder of her husband, was given a lethal injection.
The court-ordered execution of Kelly Renee Gissendaner was carried out in accordance with state law.
Back in 1997, her then-boyfriend, Greg Owen, the man who carried out the murder, took a deal from prosecutors to testify against Gissendaner. He was sentenced to life in prison and is still eligible for parole in 2022. Earlier in the day, a letter on behalf of Pope Francis was presented to the Georgia Board of Pardons and Paroles, asking them to stop Gissendaner's execution.
Please be assured of my prayers as you consider this request by Pope Francis for what I believe would be a just act of clemency.
The Vatican letter referenced the impassioned speech the pontiff made before Congress last Thursday condemning the death penalty. Witnesses said in her final conscious moments, Kelly Gissendaner sang Amazing Grace.
On Wednesday, Oklahoma did postpone an execution. In that case, also, Pope Francis had written a plea for clemency. On Thursday, there was an effort in Virginia to stop the execution of serial killer Alfredo Prieto. His supporters say he was mentally disabled and called into question the lethal injection drugs and whether they might cause unconstitutional pain and suffering. But the U.S. Supreme Court rejected a bid for a stay of execution. The Pope was in Philadelphia last weekend, and CBS News correspondent Alan Pizzi reports on the Catholic leader's flight home last Sunday night into Monday.
Overall, Pope Francis pronounced himself well pleased with his first ever visit to the United States.
In a 47-minute exchange with reporters on his plane shortly after takeoff, he called sexual abuse by priests a sacrilege and for the first time held bishops to account as well. Those who cover this up are guilty, he said, even some bishops who covered this up. It's something horrible. As for victims and their relatives who could not forgive abusive priests, Francis said he fully understood. I pray for them. I do not judge someone who is not able to forgive, he said. Asked if he supported Catholics who opposed laws such as those legitimizing same-sex marriage, a reference to Kim Davis, the Kentucky worker who refused to issue licenses for same-sex couples, Francis said conscientious objection was a human right, even for government officials.
That from CBS's Alan Pizzi. At the Vatican, a spokesman then confirmed that the Pope had met with Kim Davis briefly as part of a series of visits by people when he was in Washington, adding that does not mean that he endorses everything Davis has said and done. Davis, by the way, is not Roman Catholic. Then we learned that also while in Washington, the Pope granted an audience to a same-sex couple, two men, one of whom had been his student years ago in Argentina. Here in this country, an increasing number of high schools do not have football teams. CBS's Don Daler reports.
Let's go, Isaac!
Football runs through Isaac Pearson's bloodline. Both his father and brother played. But the sophomore from Maplewood, Missouri, chose a different field.
My mom's like, no, soccer's your thing. You know, she doesn't want me to get hurt, but, you know, soccer is something I really liked.
Pearson's school also has a proud tradition of football, having gone to the state championship as recently as 2010. But there is no team at Maplewood this season. Maplewood had a hard time finding enough players due to injuries and lack of interest. Nelson Mitten is president of the school board.
When you have low numbers of students from a school of this size, you're drawing all the way from freshmen to seniors. If we didn't have the signs, that could have a significant effect upon the possibility of injuries.
Going against some bigger teams.
Absolutely, and that was a difficulty for us also.
The number of high school football players in the U.S. has declined by 25,000 over the past 5 years. Last year, five high schoolers died playing football. That's more deaths than in college, semi-pro, or professional levels. Still, Maplewood senior Ramel Person misses the game.
I mean, when I first heard about it, I was like devastated because like football was my favorite sport.
Students at Maplewood will still get to attend the annual homecoming game next month. But for the first time, the sport will be soccer. Don Daler, CBS News, Maplewood, Missouri.
Up next, the latest on unemployment, then Donald Trump's tax plan.
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. The CBS News Weekend Roundup, after this short break.
With KudaSign, paperless e-signing is a no-brainer for any business that requires legally binding signatures fast. That's because KudaSign offers everything you should expect from an electronic signature solution for just $1 per month. KudaSign cuts document turnaround time as much as 90%, thanks in part to its number one rated mobile app. And KudaSign's secure cloud stores documents for on-demand tracking and retrieval. Get KudaSign now for just $1 per month. Go to KudaSign.com. That's KudaSign.com.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's Dan Ravine.
The unemployment rate stands steady at 5.1%, but the monthly report from the government on jobs was disappointing on Friday. The goal lately has been a net gain per month of 200,000. In September, it was 142,000, and July and August numbers were revised downward.
We've seen that the job market has started to weaken. Average hourly earnings were basically unchanged. That follows a 9-cent gain in August. So we're just getting earnings up by about 2.2% year over year. And overall, I think this is a disappointment. People really were hoping to see a much more dramatic acceleration in the job market, and that is yet to occur.
That's CBS News business analyst Jill Schlesinger.
One glimmer of hope in this report is the number of people who are working part-time because they can't get full-time work, that actually declined by almost 450,000, down to 6 million in September. This is a good measure because there has been concern at the Federal Reserve that many of the people who are surveying are having to work multiple jobs just to make ends meet.
In the race for the White House, the Republican candidate who's top of the polls, Donald Trump, unveiled his tax plan.
It will provide major tax relief for middle income and for most other Americans.
He calls it simplification with lower tax rates. CBS News correspondent Major Garrett took a look.
Under Trump's plan, workers earning less than $25,000 a year would pay no federal income tax. The top bracket would shrink from nearly 40% to 25%, and the corporate tax would fall from 35% to 15%.
All of this does not add to our debt or our deficit.
But an independent analysis says Trump's plan would cost the Treasury $10 trillion over 10 years and increase the nation's $18 trillion debt. Howard Gleckman of the nonpartisan Tax Policy Center.
Congress would never pass something like this. Even a Republican Congress would probably never pass something like this.
Would never pass the Trump plan.
Would never pass a Trump plan because they would look at the deficit consequences and it just would be impossible.
Trump, like Ronald Reagan before him, promises economic growth, triggered by lower federal taxes, will make up for most of the lost revenue.
We're looking at a 3%, but we think it can be 5%, it could even be 6%. We're going to have growth that will be tremendous.
Frankly, that's implausible. Some would say it's ridiculous. No tax proposal is going to double economic growth.
To offset the tax cuts, Trump would slash government spending by as much as 20% and eliminate some tax deductions and credits. But Trump would leave in place two of the largest deductions for mortgage interest and charitable contributions.
It sounds like a great idea, but where's the money going to come from?
Economic models show Trump's tax cuts could, over 10 years, create more than 5 million new jobs and increase wages more than 6%. But the bottom 10% of American wage earners would get a fraction of the 15% tax cut Trump's plan would shower on the wealthiest 10%.
That from CBS News Chief White House Correspondent Major Garrett. One bright spot for the economy, automobile sales. Jeff Gilbert of CBS Radio's WWJ in Detroit.
September was helped by a strong Labor Day performance and some new products, particularly strong inventories of Ford's new F-150 pickup that boosted Ford sales up 23% over last year. Jeep helped Fiat Chrysler sales increase 14%. GM sales were up 12%.
Americans are buying cars, vans, and trucks, but not Volkswagen diesels, since that German manufacturer admitted that 11 million of its diesel cars contain software designed to fool emissions tests, and the engines emit a lot more pollutants than previously thought. A big recall will begin. CBS's Omar Villafranca in Texas reports VW dealers have suddenly hit a wall.
How many cars do you have here that you can't sell?
You're looking at 52 right now.
Alan Brown is the general manager of the largest Volkswagen dealership in North America, a few miles north of Dallas. Brown admits he was blindsided by the news of the cheating scandal.
My first reaction was shock. And then I think you go through just a ton of emotion at that point. And then very quickly you go back into business mode.
Angry customers lashed out at Volkswagen on Twitter, one saying, "Buy it back." Brown says 20% of his fleet is shelved after Volkswagen ordered dealers to stop selling the cars affected by the software. That could cost his dealership roughly $1 million in potential sales a month.
Are you having to look at possibly lay off employees, cut hours?
We're not there yet.
But used Volkswagens with the fraudulent software are still being sold on the secondary market. CarMax, the largest used car retailer in the country, has a few hundred of the impacted cars on their lots and told CBS in a statement that they are going to keep selling them. Parts and service departments are bracing for as many as 500,000 U.S. customer cars needing repair. Jim Gross owns one of the affected cars.
They cheated, right? I mean, that's really what happened, is they cheated on these tests. And you know, I don't appreciate that as a consumer and as somebody who's at least a little bit concerned about, you know, environmental issues. It's disappointing.
Let's drill a little deeper with CBS News transportation correspondent Chris Van Cleve. As far as we know, at least, Chris, what did the Volkswagen software do?
It was set up to take several sensor inputs from the steering wheel, from the engine, to determine when the car was being emissions tested instead of being driven. It knew that when you drive, you move the steering wheel. And, you know, the engine runs a certain way, you accelerate a certain way. When it wasn't doing that, it registered that, oh, I'm being emissions tested. So it changed the engine to a different mode that was compliant with the emissions test.
Of California, of the U.S.?
It met the U.S. requirements. Basically, emission standards are known. So you know what the questions are going to be. You know what the answers they're looking for are. This software made the car switch into test mode by realizing, oh, I'm being tested. Okay, I'm going to be compliant. As soon as you take that car out on the road and drive it, it went into another mode, and the EPA found that the emissions were 10 to 40 times above acceptable levels.
What has Volkswagen done? We've noticed that the share price went down like 20% a day. The company apologized. The CEO resigned. But has the company revealed who had this idea? Who did it?
And the company has launched an investigation, as has the Department of Justice and several European countries. That's the big question. Who was responsible? This is different than the defects we have seen in some cars recently, the ignition issue, the airbag issue, in that you had to design this into the car. Somebody had to write the software code. Somebody had to decide to create this defeat device. So there's a level of premeditation here that's a little bit different than defects when we've talked about other things that have prompted recalls. The fact that it was a conscious act, that could lead to there being a, this is the person, these are the people, And then the question becomes, what kind of charges might they face?
They might be criminal charges for even defrauding the customers who thought they were driving a clean car. Some people will be upset to think they were emitting way beyond the regulations.
Volkswagen owners are really angry.
A major humiliation for Volkswagen. Chris Van Cleve, CBS News transportation correspondent. Thank you, Chris.
Sure thing.
Please follow us on Twitter for the latest headlines at CBS Radio News. And I'm at Dan Raviv.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, a wrap-up of the week with the correspondents who cover the news. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's correspondent Dan Raviv.
Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, seized the world stage this past week, not just by being interviewed on CBS's 60 Minutes or giving a speech in New York at the UN General Assembly. It's not only words, it's action. As we've reported, Russia's Air Force has started bombing people in Syria who oppose the dictatorship of President Bashar al-Assad, who's a Russian ally. And the Russians say they will do more against the terrorists of ISIS than the U.S. and its allies have managed to do. Marvin Kalb, a former correspondent in Moscow and the State Department for CBS and NBC, you've written a book about Putin, specifically his invasion of Crimea and Ukraine. The book is Imperial Gamble, published by the Brookings Institution. Marvin, Crimea was last year, so is Syria the next step in Putin's adventurism?
You know, in a way, Dan, it's really a continuation of what he did in Ukraine. In Ukraine, he decided to gamble that he could use his military force to achieve two aims. One was to impose a Russian will over the destiny of Ukraine, and second, to build up his own political strength at home as a strong leader. Now, as he moves into Syria, he is in effect doing essentially the same thing. He is proving to the world that if you want to achieve a political or diplomatic aim, the best way of doing it is to utilize your military force, utilize it in a big, dramatic way, and then wait for the political chips to fall in. That is, I think, what he is trying to do in addition to reestablishing and strengthening the Russian presence in the Middle East.
And as you see it, by the way, the Crimea-Ukraine invasions last year, did that work for Putin, especially building up his own prestige at home? Did it work?
It worked in terms of building up his prestige. I mean, his numbers in all polling operations are somewhere in the 80s. I don't take those numbers very seriously, but nevertheless, that's the best gauge that we have. What he has done, however, is set off a series of events, including sanctions from the West against the Russian economy, and now the Russian economy is hurting and hurting bad. And so right now, Putin is doing well in projecting Russian power overseas, but the Russian people see that Russian economic power at home is hurting bad.
Well, just a few days ago, President Obama had a meeting with Putin at the United Nations in New York. I thought both leaders were, you know, trying not to smile or look too friendly. Of course, they probably don't actually, shall we say, love each other at this time. Did Putin put the U.S. in some sort of a trap? This is trouble for Mr. Obama?
Oh, I think it's very much trouble, not only for Obama, but for the entire West. What Putin has done is use a small beachhead in Syria, which he has had for several decades now, and grow it so significantly that he can, within 2 days after speaking at the UN, get his own legislature, and this is no big deal since the legislature in Moscow is a rubber stamp, but he got them immediately to say and to authorize the legitimacy of using Russian air power in Syria.
Russia seems to be the leader of what he proposes as a new coalition based in Baghdad, Iraq, he says, and clearly working with Iran. This is one of the consequences, perhaps, of that Iran nuclear agreement.
Well, it could be one of the consequences. I have a feeling whether the agreement was reached or not, Putin probably had in the back of his head a plan according to which Russia, Iran, Iraq, and Syria would in effect join together, and they have already said publicly that they are going to be sharing intelligence. And there's an irony, a historic irony here. The United States invested thousands of lives and billions of dollars in order, in effect, to be in the front row of those nations helping out and influencing the Baghdad government. And right now, Putin very quickly has managed to put us not into the back, but certainly no longer in the front.
Therefore, in part because President Obama has just under 16 months left in office and there will be a new president, do you think the whole world is waiting to see who will lead the United States starting in January 2017?
I think that is so true. The next president of the United States, just start with Syria and go on from there, is going to have an agenda of terrifyingly difficult and dangerous subjects, and he's going to have to find the wisdom to deal with both foreign and domestic policy. It's going to be a tough agenda, tough.
Gee, who'd want to be president? Marvin Kalb, former journalist and Harvard professor, now at the Brookings Institution, which published your latest book called Imperial Gamble, Putin, Ukraine, and the New Cold War. Marvin Kalb, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dan.
Now a new offer of internships, including business cards and a new suit for low-income Americans in the inner city and rural areas if they have low grades in high school and bring up their average to at least B-. John Hope Bryant, entrepreneur and philanthropist based in Los Angeles, you call this the Hope B-minus Business Compact. Why is this offered to kids with low grades?
When I was growing up in Compton, California, in South Central Los Angeles, I noticed that the A-plus kids were basically all fine. Either they would find opportunities or opportunities would find them, even in the hood. Certainly in the suburbs, certainly in middle-class and upper-class neighborhoods. But if you have a D, C, or an F, forget about it. And I found there's a lot of genius, a lot of brilliance of kids who have interesting grades. You know?
Well, you're suggesting you can unlock that, right? They might have low grades, C's, D's, and F's. So I think you've come up with a way of challenging them. Explain.
We made a pledge that every kid who has a D, C, or an F who pledges to get a B minus and fulfills the pledge in any year of high school, we'll give them a business internship right out of school. $500 stipend, pays for a business suit, business cards, transportation money, and food money for 6 weeks. And we'll place them into a business once they fulfill the pledge. And then here's the bet. In 6 weeks, the kid will change the business, and the business will change the kid. And now the kid has a relationship to the free enterprise system. And in Taiwan, they did this for college students who didn't have a job, and they found that 70% of those who had free internships were hired. So Cat Cole of Focus Brands, Cinnabon, just took five of our kids in Atlanta into her environment for internship. It was 2 weeks. After 2 weeks, the kids so blew away people in the corporate office, three of them were hired. And by the way, you don't have to be a big company. You can be a dentist with four employees and take one intern. You can run a barbershop. You can run a nail salon with two or three people and take on one intern. $500, that's $41.60 a month. That's like the cost of a bad meal. You can change somebody's life. And if we could reintroduce the internship generation in America, you change America. So if we can give them, connect education to a job, education to an opportunity, we found the kids do show up. They are actually very studious. This is possible, and we found that people, these kids are overwhelming, not underwhelming, consistently.
John Hope Bryant speaking about the Hope B-minus Business Compact. It got some support at the Clinton Global Initiative. More on that later in our broadcast.
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. The CBS News Weekend Roundup, after this short break.
In 2001, Vonage revolutionized home phone service with voice over internet. After such a colossal breakthrough, who would have objected if Vonage said, "Enjoy better, world. Vonage will be spending some me time at the spa." But the thing about better is, there's always more better. So today, Vonage is not at the spa having its trouble area worked on by a masseuse named Moonshadow, but with its nose to the grindstone, transforming communications for your business by making it better. With a cloud-based infrastructure that grows as your business grows, seamless mobility between all devices so you don't miss that important call, even while Moonshadow is walking down your spine. And all for less than you think. So while you're getting your mani-pedi, Vonage's toenails remain a complete disaster, because Vonage is still out there working to make more better. See how your business can get the better it deserves. Call Vonage at 1-800-5-VONAGE or go to Vonage.com. Vonage, the business of better.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, Here's Dan Revie.
Writing about the closing session of the Clinton Global Initiative last weekend, the Wall Street Journal says CGI lost some of its mojo. A lot of big corporate executives did not show up, and one reason could be that some don't want to be identified with the Clintons while Hillary Clinton is running for president. We had a chance to speak with the president of CGI, Bob Harrison. He reminded us that Bill Clinton finished his 8 years in the White House in early 2001, and in 2005, he launched this organization meant to put together donors, charities, and new projects around the world. So, Bob Harrison, what did you accomplish in your latest four-day session in New York?
President Clinton launched CGI in 2005 in September. This year, like past years, what we try to do is pull together leading representatives of the public sector, the private sector, and civil society to take action against the large global challenges that we discussed during the 3 or 4 days of our meeting. And like every year, our members make what are called commitments to action. They did the past 4 days. Over the course of the past 10 years, our members have made over 3,200. Now, with this week's commitments, it's now about 3,400 commitments that have been made. They are operating in 180 countries around the world, and they are positively impacting over 430 million people.
Have you multiplied the dollar figures, especially with about 200 new commitments? How much would it add up to?
Well, the number in total is over $100 billion.
It sounds like on average it's $10 billion a year. Does that sound about right?
That's about right.
Any slowdown or acceleration in giving? You know, there are a lot of people, Bob, and I'm sure some of the speakers and experts at your CGI sessions, who feel that the world is kind of screwed up right now with a really big number of dangerous situations, civil war in Syria, migrants on the move, instability in lots of parts of the world. Does that help in a way motivate givers to make their commitments?
No, our members have been very consistent. What we're focused on is addressing large global challenges like health, access to health, access to education, climate change, the environment, oceans in particular this year.
Some of your speakers pointed out the Syrian civil war and migrants, refugees, crises.
No, Dan, you're 100% right. And in fact, we do have commitments that are focused on the refugee situation in Syria. And we have commitments that have been made to address that, in particular in Jordan. But it's larger than that. The commitments that people make tend to focus on issues like health, education, economic empowerment, girls and women, as well as some of the crises at any moment in time.
Bob, CGI naturally is associated with the Clintons, launched by Bill Clinton. His daughter Chelsea Clinton is important there, and so was Hillary Clinton, but she's running for the White House now. So how do you avoid U.S. politics?
We completely avoid it. CGI has, from day one in September of 2005, been a nonpartisan catalyst for action. In fact, when we are in an election year, we will always invite both the Republican and the Democratic candidate to participate. We had Mitt Romney. We had John McCain, along with the Democratic candidate. So we're really a nonpartisan organization and don't get into the politics.
And specifically, Hillary Clinton stepped away in some way from the initiative?
Yeah, when she declared her presidency, Secretary Clinton resigned from the board of the Clinton Foundation and has been completely uninvolved since then in any of the work of CGI.
That's the CEO of the Clinton Global Initiative, Bob Harrison. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Dan.
One of the many nonprofits featured at the Clinton Global Initiative was Together for Girls, launched 6 years ago by business executive Gary M. Cohen. You're with the medical device company BD, Becton Dickinson. Together for Girls involves the U.S. State Department, the Centers for Disease Control, and others. The goal is to reduce violence against children, especially sexual abuse of girls. Now, Gary Cohen, you see that as a health issue.
One in four, we have data now from 17 countries. It's one of the pillars of Together for Girls. We get data from national household surveys, and then we use that data to work with the national government to mobilize a plan of action to address the issues. And the data indicates that for over one in four girls in every country polled, their first experience of sexual intercourse was forced. And for one in three of those girls, they have an unwanted pregnancy as a result. Mm. And you can imagine what it would be to be a young teenage girl and to be pregnant and then face a 5 times higher risk of maternal mortality compared to women. There's also nearly a 4 times higher risk of contracting an infectious disease like HIV and AIDS. So this is a very serious issue. And it's also affiliated with chronic disease, with substance abuse, because the girl's life changes, and even thoughts of suicide and attempts at suicide. And I'm sad to say, suicide is now the leading cause of death among adolescent girls. This is a problem in every country. This is not unique to developing countries. It's right here in the United States, it's Western Europe. We started in developing countries because of the high prevalence of infectious disease. That's what really drew me in. I was working on HIV and AIDS and my professional responsibilities, and I started to note that girls and young women were 3 to 4 times higher prevalence rates with HIV and AIDS relative to their boy and young men counterpart. And I knew something was wrong. There hadn't been anything being done about it at that time, and that's why we mobilized Together for Girls.
And you help pay for treatment, and some of that could be psychological.
Yes. In fact, mental health support is one of the most critical factors in enabling girls to overcome this. And some, sadly, don't overcome what happens to them, because the reality is today, if girls report having been sexually assaulted or raped, they're usually further victimized as a result. So there needs to be more intervention. And Together for Girls has 3 pillars. We get the national data. That's used to mobilize the government to make a series of changes, changing laws, training police officials for how to deal with this, making changes in the courts, as well as services for victims and prevention programs. And then we engage in global advocacy to raise greater awareness of this issue.
Gary M. Cohen, we've been talking about your involvement as co-founder of the nonprofit Together for Girls. Gary Cohen, thanks very much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity.
And now our weekend roundup commentator, Charles Grodin.
I like to think of myself as above average in the empathic department, meaning I can have feelings of looking out for others, not just my family and myself. Recently, a fly was buzzing around me in my living room. I eventually got it. Then I spent more time than you can imagine saying to myself, you had a book published about a fly, Freddy the Fly, where the fly is the hero, and you just killed one. I got over it, somewhat. More recently, a bigger bug was buzzing around indoors. I got that one. Then the guilt came back. What to do? Stop writing books where the insect is the hero? Hope that will relieve me of my guilt feelings, but between you and me, I doubt it. I'm Charles Grodin for the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
You can hear the Weekend Roundup anytime. Find us on the internet or use the CBS Radio News app for your phone.
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's correspondent Dan Revie.
Perhaps you remember that on 9/11, when Arab terrorists attacked America by hijacking 4 airliners, crashing 2 into the World Trade Center in New York, 1 into the Pentagon, and 1 went into the ground near Shanksville, Pennsylvania, because courageous passengers fought back, President Bush was kept away from Washington to keep him safe. CBS News analyst Mark Rosenker, you were a retired Air Force general on that day 14 years ago, a trusted aide to President Bush, head of the White House military office. You were with him as he visited a school in Sarasota, Florida. That's when the devastating news came in.
Dan, we were in the motorcade on our way to the elementary school, and about 2 minutes before we actually arrived, my communications officer, presidential communications officer, who was riding in the front of the vehicle, turned around to me and said, "Sir, I just got a call from the President's Emergency Operations Center, the PEOC, saying that an airplane had hit one of the towers at the World Trade Center." And I was kind of confused in that, one, why would I get this type of information? But two, the next thing I thought of was that this had to be a low ceiling and perhaps a very small airplane accidentally was in the wrong area and crashed into the building.
You assumed it was an accident, and without further information, you thought probably a private plane.
Absolutely. In my wildest dreams, I didn't think it would be an airliner.
Obviously, things got a lot worse after you and the president got to the elementary school. What did you hear? And remind us how the president got that news, the second plane.
Well, the first one was still we were kind of confused. And when we finally arrived at the actual elementary school, as the president was getting out and shaking hands and working his way into the holding room, into the school, and then getting ready to basically go into the elementary school room and do the event. I had gone up to Andy Card, who was the president's chief of staff, and suggested that we had just heard something from the PEOC about an airplane hitting the tower. He said, "Do you know any more?" I said, "No, but I'll stay on it." And he walked in and went in with the president. And then, of course, he stayed in the holding room as the president went in to do the event. He asked me if I could find a television, which I went around the area and found one of those audio-visual carts that we all kind of remember when we were in school. We pushed the thing in. I plugged it into the little cable connection. We turned on the TV to watch the network news, and people then began to tell us that this was an airliner. And all of a sudden, while we were watching this, the second airplane at that point struck the tower. Andy Card then left immediately, went out to whisper in the ear, and that's the famous photograph of him telling the president, "Mr. President, a second plane has struck the World Trade Center. America is under attack."
So you quickly realized, as head of logistics for Air Force One, that you probably would have to get on the move with the president.
There needed to be quick action as it related to what we were going to do with the president, how we were going to get him out of there, where we were going to go. And then, of course, those at the Pentagon needed to also be on the highest alerts that they possibly could be on. The first thing we needed to do was get the president out of the school and into the air on Air Force One, which is the safest place he could be. We originally thought we were going to go back to Washington, but once we had heard, and this was only about 2 or 3 minutes into our motorcade ride, that the Pentagon had been struck, we knew we could not take the president back to Washington. The question is where were we going to go? And at that point, I'm reminded that I had retired a colleague of mine at Barksdale Air Force Base only about 6 months before this, and I knew that there was a conference room that we could put the president in to do any type of a formal press availability to be able to say and let the American people see that the president was safe and in command.
So as the civilian in charge of the White House military office, you're saying you thought of Barksdale Air Force Base.
I suggested that to our basically the team that was making these decisions, which was Andy Card, the mill aide, and the chief of the detail of the Secret Service. The four of us were in the president's office talking while he was actually talking to the vice president back in Washington. We knew we had to take him someplace where he needed to be seen. It needed to be safe. It needed to be secure. It needed to be relatively close. And, of course, Barksdale was in Louisiana. We made this decision as we were flying over the Gulf.
You mentioned that he was in his office. You mean the office inside Air Force One, still considering where to go?
He really wanted to go back to Washington, where he was the commander-in-chief and believed he was supposed to be.
Just to be clear, that means the president of the United States doesn't always decide where he's going, or he had to be persuaded by security and other officials that going to Barksdale in Louisiana was the best idea.
Well, frankly, he had to be persuaded, and I think it was the vice president who finally said, "Mr. President, the best place you can be is outside of Washington right now."
On a secure phone line from the White House, and we know that Vice President Cheney and other officials were under the White House in a special emergency command center, so they were relatively safe. How long did you stay at the base in Louisiana, and what was next?
At that point, we needed to go on to an area where we had significantly more command and control capability. That's where we went to Offutt Air Force Base, into a bunker there where STRATCOM is located, where all control of the armed forces and our nuclear capability was available to. Never was that ever a question, but it is the best place for the president to get a full situational awareness outside of Washington.
And Offutt is in what state?
That's in Nebraska.
In Nebraska, Louisiana to Nebraska. And again, about how many hours do you think you were in Louisiana with the president?
I don't think we were on the ground any more than 90 minutes, if it was even that long.
In the years that followed 9/11, you served on the National Transportation Safety Board and became chairman of the NTSB. And now you're a CBS News consultant on these issues. How much safer are we? The traveling public wonders, could 9/11 happen again in that way?
I think we've worked very hard recognizing that the enemy has a fascination, a fixation on aviation. So we have done, I believe, a very good job of securing our nation's airspace. And but again, we're only as good as our last flight, and we have to keep the vigil. We have to stay ahead, not just up with them, but ahead of any of the types of potential threats that they may wish to demonstrate that they can try. We have to be ahead of them to be able to suppress it.
Reminiscing poignantly and intelligently about that awful day 14 years ago, September 11th. That's Mark Rosenker of CBS News. Thanks so much, Mark.
Good to be with you, Dan.
Thank you to our listeners for being with us. And anytime you want to hear us, please do a web search for CBS Weekend Roundup. You'll find our podcasts also on iTunes and other podcast services. And our app for your smartphone is CBS Radio News. I'm Dan Revive. Bye.
You've been listening to the CBS News Weekend Roundup. The program is produced in the Washington Bureau of CBS News. The executive producer is Howard Arenstein.